So to give you a little bit of background on this topic in India, in terms of HIV in India, it's not really the proportion who are infected. It's pretty low, but because it's really the sheer number who are affected. So between 2.1 and 3 million have HIV in India. And Andhra Pradesh, where the study was conducted, is one of the states that has the highest rates of HIV. And it's in the southwest or southeast part of the country. Oh, sorry. And female sex workers are the population, or one of the groups who are among the greatest risk for HIV. And so over the past decade, there's been increasing research and programming focused on HIV prevention among female sex workers. And a lot of this has been conducted in a small city called Rajahmundry in Andhra Pradesh. And a few years ago, I was hired. So a lot of these foundation, like Ford Foundation, Gates, have been doing research in the city. And I was hired many years ago to be part of a research study with a social behavioral survey among women working in sex work to try to understand risk factors for HIV. And one of the things that I always wondered, because before these studies came in, this was such an isolated place. And there just was not any services for this population of women. There was no attention that these women even existed. And so all of a sudden, you know, there's these big foundations coming in doing all this work. And so I was really interested to know, like, what women's perspectives were regarding the research, what they thought the motivations of the researchers were. And this opportunity by the Fordham Research Ethics Training Program really allowed me to be able to continue this work and look into this. So a lot of the work that I was involved with is looking at some of the challenges that were affecting women's HIV risk. And women report high levels of stigma and discrimination. And we saw this with, you know, really high levels of police violence and harassment, client violence against women. Women were reported to high levels of evictions. If landlords found out that they were sex workers, they would become evicted, family rejection, and all of these were not only associated with HIV risk, but are really important to think about in terms of conducting research for this population. And so, you know, while we've always prioritized things like confidentiality, privacy, and respect, that would be so important to address in a population that faces such high levels of stigma. You know, we have all these standard guidelines that we follow in all our research ethics protocols, but we've never really received any community feedback, and we don't really know how well we were doing. And so the current study aims to evaluate this. So we did this qualitatively, like Leanne's study, we interviewed women, and the primary focus was on confidentiality, privacy, and respect. So we interviewed 30 women who reported participating in at least one study in the past 3 years. And we recruited them from a community-based organization called Nari Saksham. And we did this because these are women who are really leaders in the community. And so, you know, they're the ones who are the most likely to participate in research. And if anyone ever had any bad experiences as a research participant, these are the women who would know about it. So they were individual interviews that lasted about an hour. We had interview guides that we got some community advisory. So we had a small community advisory board that we got some feedback. And we also piloted with the first 5 women. And women were reimbursed 300 rupees, which is approximately $6. We used transcripts of all the interviews, and we did a short demographic survey as well to characterize the sample. And of course, all study procedures were approved by relevant IRBs. And so in the interviews, we really tried to focus on everything, like all the parts of the study involvement, from, you know, the time of recruitment, or even when they first heard about the study, all the way down through the consent process, all the study involvement, whether it was a survey or HIV testing, until the final reimbursement. And we really focused, again, on the issues of confidentiality, privacy, and respect. In terms of data analysis, we We did standard procedures for qualitative data, so we had two independent coders, and then the quantitative survey was mostly descriptive. So here are some of the sample characteristics. Their average age was 37. This is a sample that's largely unmarried currently, and although 60% reported having a boyfriend. And this is very similar to the larger survey studies as well. And the majority of women reported working in multiple settings. A lot of the common ones were working in a lodge or a brothel, agricultural fields. Some worked at home or on the highway. All of the women participated in at least one research study in the past year. Most of these were social and behavioral survey research studies. Some included HIV testing as well. And then some of them were qualitative interviews where women were interviewed, like life history interviews, trying to understand the challenges that are associated with HIV risk. And so some of the results, just a big picture, some of the results, we really found that the consent process was really important for ensuring confidentiality. The staff gender and demeanor was really important for respect. Staff training was so important, not only for respect, but also in terms of privacy. Things around the survey content, we had issues with sensitive questions, and a real need for community support by women. And so the next few slides, I go one by one through these and give you some examples using some of the quotes from women. So first, in terms of confidentiality and privacy, not surprisingly, women really reported a huge fear that their, you know, anything that they shared would be released or it would be talked about or wouldn't be kept confidential. And then we did find some reports were violations of privacy as well that were actually really surprising. In terms of the fears, I hear a couple of quotes related to that. A lot of women said this too. I had the fear that these people might give my interview to the TV and newspapers. All the women were scared that people would hand us over to the police after. One of the things that women said is, like, after the consent process, and they heard, you know, all the details that we were going to do to make sure that their names weren't associated with the data, that seemed to help them, you know, address their concerns. And this woman says, after reading the consent form, we came to know that except for our ID numbers, our names would not be written. These were all told beforehand. We got confidence that they would keep confidentiality of us. And so there were a couple incidents, like I said, of where privacy was violated. One woman says, then the counselor informed them that they have HIV. She's supposed to inform one after another privately. She, referring to the HIV testing counselor, looked at four women who sat on a bench and said, you know, you have HIV, you have HIV, you have HIV. Yeah. So definitely some implications on more training and oversight at the clinic site as well. Another one, the survey staff would make the women sit in a group, which it sounded like this was a focus group session, and ask, do you have HIV? Did you go for CD4 tests? Since how long have you been with this disease? Since how long have you been in sex work? And so she's saying, you know, they should have asked these privately. And so one of the things that I think was happening that women were talking about is that, like, it, clearly this was not a study that was IRB approved. So I think that locally, like, some students at universities were coming in and doing these small studies. And so it definitely implications on more efforts to try to protect against these kind of things or prevent these things. In terms of respect, the biggest things were the interaction with staff. I mean, staff really, it was a huge issue in terms of making sure that women felt respected during study involvement. And then again, disrespectful questions, the sensitive nature of the questions is so important to address. And they give us some important feedback on how some of their concerns related to the questions were addressed, which I think is helpful. And to start on a positive note, a lot of women also reported very positive things. So this woman says, the women who were employed to interview us treated us like sisters. Sometimes they would get tears when they were giving our responses. And so this is very common. But there were also a lot of women who talked about bad interactions with staff as well. This woman says, yes, she, referring to the interview facilitator, got several phone calls. I was interviewed by a young girl, so clearly there's this implications for increased staff training. And in terms of the gender of the female or the facilitator, women really preferred women as facilitators. This person says, there is a difference talking to the women interviewer. How can we inform male interviewers that we were beaten here and there? How could we tell them that we slept with this man and that man? How can we tell them that I used a condom during the last encounter? How can we tell them, can we discuss these things with men? I cannot. And we even found that there are some examples where the males who were facilitators, really, I mean, it's not even just about disrespect, but it was sort of a betrayal of trust. This one, she says, he, the research interviewer, developed an affair with a sex worker. He also took his friends to the women, just like a broker. That is not a sensible thing. He took his friends to that area later that night. And another example, one man came for a survey. I served him, had sex with the hope of getting a loan to start a shop. The next day he packed the things and went away. We signed on the papers. That is the reason why I stopped believing others, because they are deceiving like this. I think this is another example of people posing as researchers and coming in because of the high level of research that was going on. This definitely, again, has huge implications for how to work with the community to make sure that they know ahead of time whether this is legitimate research. And then, you know, this is something that was so common too, and I never thought about it when I was conducting the research. A lot of times you pay the research facilitators by the survey that they complete. Ten of them, we can reach our target. That was their style. And so we got this over and over again. I think this is like so interesting. I never thought about like the actual, I mean, you think of research ethics protocols in terms of like the study design and all the steps they're taking to protect, but you never think of like the way that you pay staff has a direct influence on the ethical conduct of research. And then women reported incidents when interviewers asked offensive questions. She asked, when the man has a wife, why should you sleep with him? Or why do you need a temporary husband or boyfriend? Is it not enough to have a husband? And so, I mean, these were clearly not questions in the survey, too. They were questions that the women facilitators were asking as a response to some of the things that the women were saying. And I think in some instances, the women were telling us this stuff, not realizing that this was not part of the survey. You know, women, the facilitators are just asking questions one after another. And so it would be really hard to know, like, what was part of the survey and what wasn't. It's really disrespectful. And then, again, like, Leanne's data as well, like, a lot of the questions were just so sensitive. This woman says, if the women are asked questions like, how many condoms does a woman use? How many encounters does she does? It would be upsetting. She would feel bad, you know. Women would say, why is it that they were paying to get answers to these questions? So it really made them, you know, become suspicious of the motivations of the research staff. And one thing that they said was helpful was, you know, just the staff demeanor, the rapport that was established. This woman said that the first time I was scared and thought why she was asking such shameless questions. I started looking down to hide my face. Then she told me, do not feel scared or shameful. I am also a woman like you. I too serve my husband the same way. That is why I could ask you. After she told that, I did not feel that she is someone out of my community. I felt like she was my friend or fellow sex worker. And later I got used to it. Another thing that women said was helpful to address some of the concerns related to the sensitivity of the surveys or sensitive nature of the questions is just discussion within the community. So I think over time, as you know, women were participating in more and more research, there's more discussion within the FSW community around, you know, why these questions are so helpful and how they're informing programs. And this woman said, you know, that was in the beginning, but later we came out and discussed among our community members. We felt that they were for our benefits. We gave a thought on the questions. Then we realized that the researchers wanted to know what kind of difficulties sex workers are facing. And so just some of the limitations, just briefly. Of course, you know, this sample, the generalizable, it's mostly generalizable to, you know, this context, and particularly these women from the community-based organization. But I think it has huge implications for other similar populations elsewhere. And I know even in my other studies that I've been involved with since, I've incorporated a lot of these things. You know, just thinking about some of the major findings of the study, I've changed some of the ways that we have implemented other studies as well. And I incorporated feedback early on. I think that's so important. I think this study really shows that if there's a way to get community feedback on how the study is being conducted early on, that you can really change some of the way or improve some of the ethical conduct of the research. And just wanted to, again, acknowledge the interview facilitator who was wonderful, and the two RAs who helped code all the data, and of course Dr. Celia Fisher, who is the PI of the training grant and the director of the training institute where we all did this work, and my other co-authors, Kim Blankenship and Kaveh. Thank you. Oh, sure.
The original study? The ethics study.
Well, so within as a trainee, all of us were awarded some funding to be able to carry out this work. And so I did this proposal to interview all the 30 women, and I hired this researcher, the interview facilitator, to do all the interviews.
You did get the hire, but that must have been a very interesting process.
I hired the interview facilitator who did all the interviews. She's somebody that I had worked with, because I had worked for years doing the data collection. We had a huge survey. There was 1,000 women that I was taking the lead on, you know, to do all the data collection. And that's when I, like, you know, was seeing all of this and wondering what women were thinking in terms of the research, what their experiences were as participants in the research, and then, you know, what their perceptions were related to the motivations of the research as well. And so when I was given this opportunity to be a fellow and have some funding, I thought this was a perfect way to be able to explore some of that.
Your new studies, the women in Mexico, are going to benefit from their burden, which, you know, that's part of research. You take on burdens for other people, and I get that. But when we start to put all these comments, just the collection of all of them, this feeling of, you know, is it really just? And in IRB, it's hard for them to really look at this in context because they're not that community. But is it just for us to very small town, never touched before, suddenly a bunch of foundation money gets poured into
I think that's why I started the study, because I was like, I don't know, I just felt like so much money was going in, and it was just like, I was just, I don't know, I was just really wondering why, you know, what the impact was. So another one of the studies that came out of this, I didn't have time to include today, but we asked women about their, you know, the benefits that they experienced, and women really, I mean, they were saying that, like, you know, this was the first time that anyone had paid attention to them. And, like, they would be interviewed and, like, realize for the first time in their life how much they had gone through, all of their struggles, and, like, and were just, like, so proud to be able to say, like, I have accomplished all of this. And, you know, and I still keep going and be recognized for their hardships. And so I think that was really, really impressive to me. And then, and so we have another paper coming out on some of that as well. But also, you know, what I saw, I mean, a lot of this was intervention work, too. It really mobilized the women. I mean, some of this was already happening in the community, but I think, like, women before these studies really felt like they were saying, I was afraid my story would go to the newspapers. But then after all of these research studies, they started to realize, oh, wait, there's, like, so many other women out there who are just like me doing the same kinds of things. And so it really mobilized the community as well. And people started realizing that, you know, there's so many more women who are doing the same thing. And they have this community-based organization now called Nari Saksham. And so they really take the lead. They go and work with police to educate police. And so we did three waves of data collection. We've seen police violence go down, client violence go down. I think even, I have to check, but I think even, like, abuse from boyfriends and things like that. So, and we've seen condom use go up. We've seen, like, all kinds of things, and a lot of it is related to this mobilization. And Elian's doing a lot of this in the Philippines and Mexico as well. But I think it really did have a positive impact on the community. But I mean, that is, like, why it started, because I wasn't sure at first. Like, some part of me felt like, and I think it's true in some ways that. And the staff who were hired in this community also benefited, really, you know, because there wasn't that much work in this community. And then, you know, people were hired to do this work. And so, I mean, I think it's an interesting question. But I think a lot of it has informed the programs that are in place, and they continue to be in place there. So I hope so. Like, yeah. Thank you.
So one of the questions that I have, I conducted my legislation for space and condo women. I had all of these kind of data challenges of as a woman. And something that I noticed within my study, a lot of times the people in the army don't really understand the complexities of the investing agency related research. So there were questions that they probably should have had me ask or not ask them for instance, but they wouldn't know because they aren't the ones that support.
I mean, I think this has shown me that, you know, if you can do a few interviews, like if you have the first several women enrolled in a study, if you have like a pilot maybe, and you can do some interviews to get feedback on how their experiences were as a participant, I think it's so helpful. And we've incorporated that into another study that I'm working on in D.C. So, yeah, I mean, I think that this is a great thing to do. I'm so grateful for Celia's guidance on all of this. It's really